Foray Ballard versus Commonwealth. Counsel for the appellant, Mr. Fox. Say that for me, sir.
Farshahi.
Farshahi. I've seen you before, and I still can't pronounce it. I'll get better. Third time will be a charm.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
May I start whenever?
Thank you very much. May it please the court, I'm Afshin Farshahi, representing Mr. Ballard, who was convicted of some credit card related charges in Virginia Circuit Court. We have raised several issues in this case. I think the first one I want to address is the issue of the hearsay evidence that was admitted through the testimony of Ms. Dial. And Ms. Dial was testifying regarding, she testified regarding a credit card being stolen from a car. And then she started talking about where her credit cards were being used, and she said it was being rejected. It was rejected a couple of locations. At that point, it was not clear how she had this information. But then when defense counsel found out that she had was testifying from her notes that she had made from a bank statements, and also I think the word that was used was third parties, which I think there was some confusion, but I think third parties probably refer to the bank statements and possibly the stores or the businesses that the
counsel.
Yes,
if you would address the sufficiency of the objection, because my concern
yes,
is,
right.
And this is at page 42 of the joint appendix. The question comes from counsel. So the information as regards the declinations of the card, that came to you from a third party?
Yes, sir.
Answer, yes. And then immediately into the objection, all right, Your Honor, I'm going to strike that portion of the testimony based on hearsay.
Yes, sir.
In normal grammatical sequence, that seems to only apply to the declinations. And, of course, the harmful part of the testimony for your client is not the declinations.
Yes, sir.
It's the other portion.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think the declination, which I wasn't even sure that was a word. I have to look it up. It is actually a word.
Yes, it is.
The declination is actually, that was actually kind of crucial to the Commonwealth's evidence, and I will explain that in a minute. But I submit to you that...
But on the value question,
yes,
the declination is irrelevant.
That's correct. It's irrelevant as long as the Commonwealth is not, obviously they can't count that as part of the value for the fraud case. That's correct. But, you know, I submit to you, if you put that argument in context, you know, here she is testifying about everything, and I submit to you that the context makes clear that that testimony, her information that she's telling the court comes from her notes from third party. Now, I understand that counsel only use the word that part of testimony based on hearsay, but I would submit to you that it states here, he also goes on to state, I did not know whether she was coming from her own records or not. No records were made available to defense counsel. So I submit to you that statement in itself kind of covers, it becomes broader than just the declination. Declination is made in the previous question, but I think I would submit to you that statement. It's certainly much broader. It really doesn't make sense for someone to object to just that part of the testimony when everything else comes from those records also, the notes from the records. And more
but
importantly...
Counsel, you can object to just a portion of a record. And unfortunately, that's where we are right now, trying to figure out.
Yes.
And I realize, you know, you've got what you've got.
Yes,
but how do we get past the fact that it reads, so the information as regards to the declaration of the card, that came from a third party, yes. Then he says, all right, Your Honor, I'd move to strike that portion of the testimony.
Yes,
and I'll agree, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to only object to that, but as you've seen from watching the writs, we see lots of things that don't make a whole lot of sense.
Yes, sir. But the purpose of this rule is to put the trial judge on notice that, hey, this is my argument, please make a ruling, and the trial judge makes a ruling. So when I say, let's put it in context, if you look at what the prosecutor states after that, the prosecutor says that, which, I mean, quite frankly, that part doesn't make sense, but she's putting the argument in context. She's saying, well, you know, she's testifying, she's referring to the actual transactions that she received from the bank. actual transactions. So the prosecutor's understanding of the objection is that the trial counsel is objecting to everything that this witness is testifying to regarding the transactions. And then more importantly, the trial judge says, well, she took contemporaneous notes, so it comes in again.
So let me try this on you.
Yes.
So if the appellant's objection is very narrow, but then the Commonwealth expands it and the judge's ruling expands it, where are we?
Well, I would submit to you that has preserved the argument.
The whole argument.
The whole argument, because now the trial judge is making a ruling on everything. Now the trial judge has...
Even if the defense attorney didn't object to everything.
Well, the defense attorney didn't use the magic word saying declinations and transactions, but
Or notes.
Or notes. So, again, it's important in a trial, as the court's fully aware, a lot of things are said. It's kind of fast moving. You got to think facts on your feet. But the more important thing is, does the judge understand what's going on? Does the judge understand what the objection is? I submit to you that the trial judge in this case clearly understood what the objection was. The prosecutor clearly understood what the objection was. The trial judge made that ruling, and the issue is preserved.
Okay.
So that's really all I can say about that issue. So assuming that the issue has been preserved, I submit to you clearly this evidence was hearsay. And I don't know of any hearsay exception that will let that come in. In the Commonwealth brief, they talk about personal business records. I submit to you I'm not aware of any such exception. There's also some attempt to fit this into some kind of exceptions, the present sense impression, past recollection recorded. Again, I submit to you none of those fits at all. And it's important to note that she's taking notes from another piece of hearsay. So these are business records, whether they're from the businesses or whether from the bank. There's no one from the bank coming in, no one from the businesses saying these are records to authenticate those records. So again, I would submit to you, is that really hearsay within a hearsay? So clearly they're hearsay.
Well, the business records themselves, assuming a proper foundation is laid for them, are not hearsay. But the problem is, it seems to me, for the Commonwealth, is you can't use an argument that I took something that I didn't admit into evidence and I didn't properly authenticate and somehow saved it by having somebody else write down what was on the document that I can't get in. So I assume you agree with that.
Yes. I was going to say that was a statement. Yes, I agree with that statement. Yes. Now, assuming that all those correct, then we move on to the sufficiency of the evidence. Now, I will...
Counsel, let's not move away from the
hearsay
yet. I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
Tell us, from a standpoint of if we determine that it was inadmissible hearsay and that it was not harmless, which convictions specifically does that affect?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, it does not affect conspiracy, which we did not raise on appeal. Here's what it goes to the fraud, to the fraud point, because... And I think there was different kinds of math that was being done. So if everything Ms. Dahl testified regarding the transactions, none of those transactions that she testified to should come in. For example, she testified to $57.62 from 7-Eleven. There was $50.70 from Jollibee. There was $59.11 from Citgo. So all that goes to make the $200 threshold for the credit card fraud. So certainly I would submit to you affects that charge, and that charge is insufficient. The second thing that it would affect is the credit card theft of Ms. Stiles' credit card. Now,
how's that?
Well, I submit to you that it kind of goes to linking the credit card, putting the credit card in the hands of my client, and saying that is the same credit card that was stolen from Ms. Dahl.
But doesn't the brother's testimony fix that?
Well, I submit to you it doesn't, because the brother's testimony is I would submit to you, somewhat vague. So, again, let's stick with Ms. Dahl. So her car was stolen. She testified she had a blue Honda Odyssey in the parking lot of Kemp's Rec Center in Virginia Beach. And she said September 28, 2013, although I think that was in response to the prosecutor's question, but that's in evidence. And she said a BB&T card, credit card. Then Shannon Ballard, my client's brother testified. He did say September 28. He said a blue van in a parking lot of Kempster Rec Center. Now,
okay, that matches up pretty well. As the owner of I'll let you know that my father owns a blue Odyssey, I know what it is.
But that was not in evidence, so that's. let's assume that we can say in general knowledge, people understand Odyssey as a van. That's fine. He identifies himself and Mr. Ballard, my client, in the photograph from the Holland Road 7-Eleven. But there's no evidence to show that credit card that was taken from Miss Holland, I'm sorry, Miss Dial, is the same one. So
didn't Shannon Ballard's testimony establish that they broke into the blue van and took the credit card? If we find that it's reasonable for the jury to believe that two blue vans were not burglarized in the Kempsville Rec parking lot on the same day at the same time within 20 minutes of each other, it strikes me that a juror could reasonably reject that hypothesis, then isn't it enough? Now, on the amount question, that's something entirely different. But why is the brother's testimony enough? It's the first time I've ever had somebody point out that the witness had 12 felony convictions, and then the other side come back, yes, but the defendant had 16.
I never raised that issue. I just threw that at those 12 convictions. But obviously we agree that this court has to accept everything Mr. Shannon Ballard said as accurate, so we're not contesting that. But I would simply submit to you that kind of evidence raises suspicion of guilt, maybe even a probability of guilt, but it's not sufficient. It would have been certainly nice to tie it up by saying, hey, this is the credit card that was Ms. Dial's, and certainly that I would submit to you evidence was not.
It's a reasonable inference from the facts, though.
I would not concede that, I would just certainly state that it is raises a reason a suspicion of guilt.
No. If the bank record had been introduced and it had been used at that 7-Eleven, you would have a much different,
yes, Your Honor.
To altogether non-existent.
I wouldn't be standing here. That is correct. And I would submit to you that we are assuming that bank record would show that the connection. I submit to you there's no evidence that shows, at least no admissible evidence. Let me put it out. If I may move to the, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm going to stop right now, and I will back up here. Thank you.
And counsel, we'll give you a little extra time on rebuttal since we took most of your time with questions.
Thank you.
And
thank
a long
you.
Statement from me.
Yeah. Okay, Ms. Martin, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. First of all, this was a bench trial, not a jury trial. Just want to make that clear. Not that it makes any difference in terms of fact finder, but just to clarify that. And the Commonwealth would ask that this conviction be affirmed because with regard to the sufficiency, the evidence was sufficient to sustain the convictions, and the court did not make a mistake in its ruling on the hearsay, and even if it did, it was harmless error.
How can it possibly be harmless given without that testimony, we don't get to $200?
Well, the reason that I say that it's harmless error, Your Honor, is that, let me say it this way. If all of Kimberly Dial's testimony was inadmissible regarding the actions on her credit cards and the money, then the error was not harmless as to the credit card fraud, because there would be no proof of enough value to get it over $200.
Because that's all of the notes.
That's
the
everything.
Testimony relating to the notes.
All of the testimony that she talked about. So yes, if that's not admissible, then the defendant's going to win on that particular conviction.
All right. So why isn't it hearsay, not within any exception?
Because first of all, we have the procedural argument that was made, and I'd ask the court to look at page 41 of the appendix and to give some context to what this was. Her testimony was. And the, well, actually starts on page 40, and defense counsel says, I noticed you were referring to some kind of notes or papers. And she says, yes. And he says, are these your personal bank records that you're speaking from? Are they notes from a third party that was giving you the information? And her response, I have three bank transactions and then the notes that were provided through the stores that they used the cards on. And he says, are the bank transactions records furnished by your bank? Are they in printed form? Yes, I have them right here. They're out in the lobby in my folder, but I have them. And he says, I'll look at them at the break. And then they move on. And he says, so as the information as regards the declinations of the card, they came to you from a third party. Yes, I've moved to strike that portion of the testimony based on hearsay. And then she says on page 43 that she got all the information through the bank and then calling the stores they used them at to get more information. So I believe that the third party context that's being talked about here is when she called the stores and got information from the stores, that his objection did not go to the bank records. And so if her testimony based on the bank statements that she had, which were her statements, and his comment about that was, well, they weren't provided to me, just kind of as an aside, but if that testimony based on her bank statements comes in and is admissible, then anything about the third party is harmless because it came in on another source.
But it seems to me that third party could also refer to a bank because it's not a party to the case, and that's
well, it could,
party.
Your Honor, it could refer to the bank. I mean, that's a way to read it. But I also think that if you look at the whole thing, when he's talking about the bank statements, when he says, are these your personal bank records? Are they notes from a third party giving you the information? That he was making a distinction between these two categories of information.
I agree with you that it seems that the procedural bar argument is a... Let's just say I think it's the stronger of your arguments. Tell me why on the merits you went, the Commonwealth is correct on the hearsay, assuming that the objection covers all of it.
Right. Well, then I think that we look at what the trial court talked about, how that these notes were being made contemporaneously, pretty much simultaneously. And while this case doesn't fall within the two exceptions, the precise exceptions that I talked about, it's sort of kind of like a hybrid of these two exceptions. It's kind of like if the court has discretion to admit the evidence, then in using his discretion, he could kind of fashion some sort of hybrid exception.
Counsel, isn't the problem with that that it allows someone to make something admissible that would not otherwise be admissible if you took the original document? I mean, aren't you in a position where if you, just because you take notes about an item that can't come in, that shouldn't make the notes admissible and information from the notes admissible?
Well, if you look at the past recollection recorded exception, which I think maybe is maybe the one that's closest here, you know, that it allows a witness to use some sort of notes that they have made about an event because they don't quite remember exactly what happened.
Well, right, but it presumes that they are the witness to the event, that they know what happened, and here she's not the person whose memory is being jogged. Her memory is being jogged as to the information that was provided to her by somebody who's not testifying. Short of it being that piece is what has to be admissible. It's not that this is what she remembers or what she was told. If you were offering it for some limited purpose as to what her understanding was, that would be one thing. But you're offering it for the truth. The Commonwealth, not you, was offering it for the truth of the matter asserted. What is the hook that gets the person who actually has the information the back?
Well, I think,
of course, my concern is, as Judge Decker was pointing out, is there's a way to get the bank record in. In fact, it's a pretty easy way to get the bank record in.
Right.
You can't get around that step by just having somebody jot down what the bank record says.
Well, I think
you have to call the bank.
What I would say, Your Honor, I mean, the best answer that I can come up with is that you know, she had her bank statements and she made some notes from her bank statements, and that is kind of like you know, the bank, getting the bank statement with this information on it, that's kind of the event that she's making the notes on. And that's kind of the best analogy that I can come up with here. Now, on the other hand, you know, the other woman testified from her about her information came from bank records, but nobody objected to that.
Right, all of that's in.
Right, nobody objected to that.
But that didn't get you
$200. So the only thing that happened with this other woman is that she brought her notes with her to the stand. If she had just said, you know, he took this, and this, and it was this amount and this amount.
Well, we don't know.
We don't know. But I mean, we might have been in a different posture.
It may have been the counsel was asleep and finally woke up and objected this time.
But well, and it may have been that the other one was just going to be a misdemeanor, so he didn't care. He thought maybe that's better than you know, that's the best I'm going to get here. And so, you know, the Ashley case, this one about where the hams were stolen from the Smithfield Packing Company or somewhere down there, where the security director made a report based on looking at the empty cartons at the loading dock and on the inventory, but then the store's inventory report was not available at trial, but his testimony from his report that he prepared, that was considered to be admissible as a business record.
But he actually saw it. If he had done it based on the inventory report as opposed to there being empty packing crates,
he needed all that information to put it all together.
Let's just cut to the chase. Your various suggested exceptions are subject to a little bit of creative action.
They're very creative.
All right, so let's talk.
That's the best I've got.
Right. So let's talk about harmless error.
All right. So if we get to harmless error, and we kind of have these two prongs. So if none of her testimony is admissible, then it only affects the credit card fraud. It does not affect the theft because we have the evidence of the theft. We have the testimony from the two victims.
When you say if all of her testimony is not admissible, you mean regarding the use of the card, not the other.
Right. I mean, I'm talking about her testimony. You know, it was the bank. I got it from the bank statements. I got it from calling.
Right.
And it was this amount at this time on that date. That particular part of the testimony. You know, not her testimony about I parked my car and it was broken into. I mean, there's been no challenge, and certainly that's admissible. And so we have the testimony from the two victims about, you know, my car was here on a certain day, I came back, my car had been broken into, my credit cards were stolen. Then we have the defendant's brother's testimony, which talked about how he was the lookout guy while his brother was the thief, that they broke into a gray Mazda, and that was Mrs. Warnikowski's car on September 20th, and also another car on September 20th, and a blue van, which was Miss Dial's car, on September 28th. And the
does breaking into Mrs. W's car and taking her card, does that support evidence of breaking into Dial's car and stealing her card?
Well, I mean, I'm just sort of, you know, talking about the whole. I mean, I there were two separate charges, and I guess,
right.
You know, the.
I don't think they're challenging the.
If somehow Dial's testimony transfers over to the other woman, well, then I'm just saying that,
okay.
You know, we have her testimony separately. But certainly, you know, Dial's testimony that her car was broken into and her credit cards were taken. We have the brother's testimony. The brother identified himself and the defendant in these videos and photos from 7-Eleven, where there was, you know, testimony from the police detective in their investigation that these cards had been used. We have the defendant's testimony, which was directly opposite, that he was not involved, had nothing to do with it. It was all on his brother. Well, the defendant had 16 felony convictions. His brother only had 12. And the trial court, under any circumstances, did not have to believe the defendant's testimony, could infer that he was lying to conceal his guilt. And so if you take all of those factors in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, you know, we do have evidence of credit card theft. And so any problem with the hearsay does not affect the theft conviction. It only goes to the fraud because we have the value problem. And then there is, as the defendant said, that in terms of the card that was declined is the one where they had the photos from 7-Eleven. So that was the connection between the 7-Eleven where they were and that card. They didn't have, and the other video came from the 7-Eleven where the third person's card had been taken. But there wasn't anything that connected the Bank of America card or BB&T card the Dial had in terms of the photo. So, I mean, I think that it does certainly go to the fraud conviction for her. As far as the fraud conviction for the other woman, you know, that would just be a misdemeanor case because we don't have enough money. And certainly I think that the reasonable inference is from the brother's testimony, you know, we took these cards and we used them. And we pretty much used them right away. Like the Mrs. Warnkowski's, she said that the card was stolen sometime between 1:45 and 3:30 p.m. She canceled it by 3:45 p.m., and it had already been used three times at a car wash, for gas, and for a movie rental. And so, you know, and that's what the defendant's brother testified, that, you know, they got gas, they went to restaurants, different things, but they used the cards as when they took them. And so certainly as far as fraud for her, you know, that it would be a misdemeanor case, but it's not going to be a felony case. So, just in summary, you know, we would say that there is a procedural problem with the hearsay question. We'd argue that the trial court, in fashioning some sort of creative response, did not abuse his discretion, and that any error in anything is going to be harmless, and that the evidence was sufficient. We'd ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions? Thank you.
All right, counsel, we're going to give you a little extra time for rebuttal. So when your red light goes on, I'll tell you when to stop after that.
You don't have to use it if you don't.
Yeah, I wasn't planning, but thank you very much.
Oh, you never know. Don't give it up until.
First of all, as far as I want to just correct something, that the credit card fraud charge actually covers both victims in this case. If you look at the indictment, the date of the offense is.
You have to aggregate to get $200.
Yes, John. So I just want to clarify that.
But you're not challenging any of the other convictions relating to Mrs. W.
Well, we are, Your Honor. We are on the credit card
on
theft. The credit card theft, we are.
You are?
Yes, yes. And we addressed that in the brief.
Okay.
So and it's a similar argument I was making in response to Judge Russell's question regarding Ms. Dial's credit card theft. On the credit card theft evidence regarding Ms. Warnkowski.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant on the hearsay. Okay.
Yes.
On the same page.
That is correct. There's no hearsay issue with Ms. Warnkowski.
Okay,
that is
good.
Absolutely correct. I mean, there could have been, but no.
You worried me. You got me worried. Okay.
So with Warnkowski's credit card theft, the evidence Ms. Warnkowski said a gray Mazda parked at the YMCA parking lot near Mount Trashmore in Virginia Beach, and she said September 20, 2013. And then she went on and state several places where her card was used, which, again, there was no objection to that evidence came in. But quite frankly, it didn't matter because when Mr. Shannon Ballard, my client's brother, testified, and here's the interesting thing about his testimony. The prosecutor very, I don't want to say any bad words about it, but just the way she asked the question, she kind of skipped through all this facts that you expect a witness to testify. There was no objection. So she put all the important information in her question. Were you in the Mount Trashmore on September 20th, 2013, you know, in a car, and regarding a gray car? Yes. And he said yes, and I guess that evidence came in. But, you know, when we're raising a sufficiency of the evidence issue, I submit to you that that kind of question kind of undermines the evidence that came in. This court still has to look at how this evidence came in. I know this wasn't an objection that we could make, but it should have been made at trial. It wasn't. But that important information that links the credit card theft to my client was embodied in the prosecutor's question. It was essentially a leading question. And there was no other information about how that card was used. I know Mr. Shannon Ballard said they stole a bunch of cards, used a bunch of stores, and he wasn't sure. I mean, he was so confused. Apparently, they had stolen so many cards.
But all evidence is admissible unless objected.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree with that, but I just want to make that observation. And the Commonwealth points out, well, my client testified concealing his guilt. Well, you know, I guess the first thing I should have said to you is my client committed a crime. There's no question about that as far as we look at the evidence in light most favorable to the Commonwealth. That's not the issue before this court. The issue before this court is whether the Commonwealth charged him with what the evidence showed that they make that link. And obviously, our answer to that question is no. That's it for my argument, unless the court has any other questions.
I do have one other question,
yes,
counsel. So if we were to reverse on the credit card fraud and remand,
yes,
would we remand for a resentencing for the misdemeanor under Commonwealth v. South?
Your Honor, actually, this issue is going to come up in another case that you're going to hear today. We are not asking the court to find my client guilty of a misdemeanor. We're asking the court to reverse the conviction for a retrial. And I think everyone has to consent, if I'm not mistaken, everyone has to consent to a resentencing on the credit card fraud.
So you're not consenting.
We are definitely not consenting.
You're not consenting.
Yes. And let me say this. It's very important. If you look at the sentencing order, the trial judge gave all the active incarceration to the credit
right.
card theft.
Right.
But our position is that the whole case has to be sent back because obviously the trial judge is going by the sentencing guidelines, which take into account all the convictions. The trial judge is going on the assumption he was convicted of all these charges. So it seems to me that the whole case has to be sent back.
Well, assuming we agree with only the hearsay
yes.
issue.
Yes.
And we were to reverse and remand
yes.
for a retrial, should the Commonwealth be so advised, it would be a retrial on the credit card fraud.
Yeah, yes, I agree with that part.
Okay.
But I guess we can deal with that at trial court.
Okay. Don't count your chickens yet,
yes,
Castle.
Yes,
okay. It was a hypothetical.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. We'll
thank
come
you
down
much.
And greet